Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Merrill Brockway, author of the new memoir, Surprise Was My Teacher, and it's all about his early days in television. Right now, I would like to welcome Scott Harrison. He is the founder of Ironweed Productions, and he is the director of the new production that they are putting on this year called The Trip to Bountiful. And Lois Viscoli joins us. She's one of the actors in Ironweed and in this play. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
Well, thank you.
It's great to have you, and it's our annual tradition that we get together and talk about the plays. And once again, Scott, a tense family drama about ordinary Americans with secrets and things to hide
all
and
that good juicy stuff
in need of a certain amount of therapy and medication.
That's the best fodder for good drama.
it really is, and I find it fascinating having watched your plays, these Ironweed productions, year after year. There really is a kind of continuity in the type of play that you choose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely do American stories, and I think too there's been a, because I mean, one of the things I love about theater is just that primal idea of not knowing what's going to happen next, and so I love those type of stories where there's just some, you know, just a great story where there's an element of suspense and again, American stories. So yeah, this definitely fits into that mold.
American stories and very distinctly family dramas that play out in a house where often two characters are in real conflict with each other, but the it doesn't explode. It's just under the surface. Your character, Lois Viscoli, once again paired with Mona Malik.
Yes.
Who's also a great actor.
Yes. Well, we both enjoyed doing what we're doing, but we do seem to be at odds a great deal of the time when we act. But there's definitely conflict, and there are problems that arise between these two characters, and I think basically they're such different kinds of people, and this is what causes the eruptions, or the, as you say, most of this is underlined, so the audience picks it up.
Now, the trip to Bountiful, let's just recap the plot very briefly. It's about a family, husband and wife, and the mother, whom you play, and the daughter-in-law and the mother do not get along very well. And it's quite painful and tense to witness this as an audience member. And the mother wants very badly to go back to the town, Bountiful,
yes,
whence she came.
Yes. And I think this is kind of a universal theme in a way. And I think the wonderful thing about this play is it's both specific and universal, in that all of us want to go. It always seems better to get back to something where we were once very happy. And especially if you're in a tense situation and you want to leave, and I think that's basically what the play is about. It's both specific to a certain area in the country, and it's also universal because it embraces these problems that we all have. You know, where was I happy? You know, why can't I go back there? You know,
right.
And the struggle to get back there. And especially fueled by present conflicts that make it even more intriguing or necessary to leave.
And this play is set in the early 1950s, is that correct?
Uh-huh, 1953, yeah.
And so it's the world that this woman left really is a world that we don't know anymore. We hear in 2010.
Right.
Yeah, and there's that sense of, because I know my father was in the military, and there was often that sense when I would leave a place, especially when I was younger, that I always wanted to go back, because you always had this view of that place that was not necessarily the reality, the situation, and I did have a couple opportunities where I did actually go back to a place we had lived before several years later, and it was, you know, it wasn't the place that I remembered, and that can be a really sobering reality. And I think, you know, Horton Foote grapples a lot with that, with what does home really mean? And for him, I think it's more of an internal place you find rather than an actual physical location.
Tell us about the playwright Horton Foote.
He's actually one of my favorite playwrights. He just passed away a year ago in March. He was 92, and he wrote over 50 screenplays and plays, mainly plays. But he won an Oscar for Tender Mercies for screenwriting, and for To Kill a Mockingbird, he adapted that story for the screen.
What a great movie that was.
Yeah.
One of the few great movies made from a great novel.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I know Harper Lee was, I've read interviews with her where she was just very, very complimentary of his adaptation of her story. He's a wonderful writer. He actually started out, he grew up in a small town called Wharton, Texas, which he kind of he uses in all of his plays. He renames it Harrison, and actually that town shows up in this play. And he left Wharton when he was about 16 to go to New York to be an actor, and soon found out that acting wasn't really his forte, but that writing was. And he was encouraged when he was studying acting to write about something that he knew from one of his mentors, and he wrote about his hometown. I think he called it Texas Town, and that's what he wrote about for the remainder of his life. I think all of his plays are set in Harrison and explore these people and this town that he grew up in when he was young.
So you have a cast of actors, some of them whom you've worked with before. Robert Knott is in this
yeah.
play, our beloved Robert
yeah.
Knott, who has done some acting, but we haven't seen him on stage all that much lately.
He's terrific. Yeah, we actually did a reading of this just around the table probably 6 years ago. And I mean, I just met Robert a few months before that. And there was something about him. I said, he just seems just completely right for this part. And so he did that reading. And, ever since then, I was like, if we ever do a production of this, I want Robert to play Ludi. And he's doing it. He's terrific in the role.
Yes, and he actually carries so much of the problem of the play because he's torn between his wife and his mother, and they are cooped up together very closely. And
in a small apartment in Houston.
To me, the play is so remarkable because it's there's another element to it I think that's very important, and that's nostalgia. You know, it's such an important element in all of our lives, you know, our remembrance of things past and wanting to get back. And what element nostalgia plays in our motives and how we engage in life, how we go on.
Yeah, it's interesting because in contemplating the play, it did make me consider, as I think it would anybody who watches it, what of our own past do we want to go back to? Do we idealize? And what do we want to just forget about and move on? You know,
right.
it's dead, it's gone, forget about
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how he, you know, Horton Foote lived. I mean, he lived in New York most of his adult life, but he kept his home in which was his parents' home in Wharton, and he went back very frequently, and he wrote a lot there. So he kind of embodied that, you know, life in the present in New York, but he also went back to the place where he grew up and had a real, real strong connection to that, which I think is really fascinating.
So you are working, Scott, how many years has Ironweed Productions been doing its thing?
Well, this year was our fifth anniversary. So 5 years ago is when we did our first production of Fool for Love. So.
Right, and so you're working with enough of the same actors that it starts really becoming an ensemble or a company that is growing together.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing is, I love working with people that we've worked with before because there's just a great, you can get to certain things quicker because you just have a history already built up. You know, you've worked together for a long time. I love that element of it, and along with that, we're just bringing in new people and just kind of, it's like fertilizing the soil. You know, we have a great group of people we've worked with a lot before, and then we've got some just wonderful actors in this one that working with for the first time. So,
What are some of the challenges for you in directing this type of play? What does it take to really make it come alive?
Well, I think the thing with Horton Foote is he's kind of got that glacier quality where you see a little bit at the surface, but there's just this mountain of inner life that all these characters are carrying underneath. And without that, the play, it just becomes kind of a sweet little sentimental play, which he's not. I mean, he's a real deep, his emotions run very, very deep. And his conflicts run very, very deep, even though they're not out on the surface as much as maybe other playwrights. So I think that the challenge is to just keep mining the inner life of these characters and not try to come up with answers too early, and just keep exploring all different types of emotions that these characters might feel, responses that they might have, to really, like I say, really build that underlife that flows throughout this play.
And that is done in, of course, through the dialogue, but also so much through facial expression and nonverbal body language.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, and I'm thrilled with the cast I have in this play. I think Horton Foote requires actors that of themselves have a real rich inner life. I mean, you can't really manufacture that. And I think the great thing about his plays is that he kind of meets you halfway. If you have actors that have a really rich inner life and they bring that part of themselves to the play, he kind of meets you with these rich, complex characters. And that's been really rewarding for me.
And I think one of the great things working with Scott, and I have a couple of times, he allows the actor to find it. He just doesn't pronounce, this is the way I want it done. He lets the actor work from within, which is an awfully important function for a good director, I feel. And Scott certainly fulfills that. And so it's been a learning experience. It's been a great experience to just work through it, you know, who you are, and letting some of the things that have been issues with you, with all actors, you know, mingle with the story itself, the storyline. So it's a challenging but fascinating experience, and we certainly have Scott to thank for a great deal of that, you know, for allowing us to work the way we have been.
So what's it like for you, who are often, Scott Harrison, in these plays, to be directing? I mean, sometimes you're not in it, and sometimes you are. Different experience, not so much?
Yeah, no, I love them both. I mean, they both feed each other. I mean, for me, I love storytelling, and it's interesting because when you're an actor, your main focus is the person or people that you're on stage with, and you just that's your main, you know, connecting with them and responding to them. And then as a director, your main focus is the audience and what they're perceiving, and are they getting the story? Where are the elements where they need, you know, they things need to be more clear, and I love that aspect of it. And it's interesting how they kind of interweave. Then now, if I, you know, act in a play, kind of, well, how does this? I think much more than I used to. Like, well, how does this character fit into the story, and what's his purpose, just specifically to tell the story? And I learned a lot about acting from directing and working with other actors, seeing how they work.
Yeah, I can imagine. And do you have, for example, during the rehearsal process, some audience members there, or people that you bring in to get another view of it?
Yeah, we had, in fact, and this year we had Wendy Chapin, who's just a fantastic acting teacher and director in town, and she came in and saw one of the rehearsals, and it was very, very helpful in terms of giving another eye and perspective on it. So yeah, I think that's hugely helpful, because you get into a point where you've been in it for so long that you sometimes can't really, you know, see it with an objective eye, and it's good to have another person come in.
Yes. Well, I think one of the great things, too, about Scott is that he is an actor's director. Since he has been through so much of our process, he empathizes with what the struggle that all actors have in creating the character. And that's such a plus for all of us in this play.
Scott Harrison is the founder of Ironweed Productions, and director of The Trip to Bountiful, which opens at El Museo Cultural this weekend.
This Thursday, yep.
This Thursday mm-hmm. night. And it's Thursday through Saturday at 8 in the evening, Sunday at 2 o'clock, and it runs through the 9th of May. So we've mm-hmm. got several weekends. Mm-hmm. And for more information and reservations, you can call 505-660-2379.
And just one quick thing I wanted to add is there is a lot of drama in this, but there is some great humor that Foot
yes.
has. And
yes, that's
we've definitely
important.
Mined that as much as we can.
Yes, absolutely. So. Oh, yeah. For sure.
Well, Scott Harrison and actor Lois Viscoli, thank you both so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for hearing us.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment with Meryl Brockway. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome Meryl Brockway. He's an Emmy Award-winning television producer and director, and he is the author of the new memoir, Surprise Was My Teacher, Memories and Confessions of a Television Producer-Director Who Came of Age During Television's Adolescence. And he will be doing a reading and book signing at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe on Friday, the 23rd of April at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, you grew up in Depression-era Indiana. You first studied to be a pianist, and then in 1950, you changed your direction and went into television. How did you choose that path?
Well, I always wanted to play the piano. And suddenly, a piano appeared in our living room, and I learned later it was from my grandmother's parlor. But I had now had a piano. And I very much wanted to start lessons, so I studied with a local teacher. And what was good for me is that my father was an amateur musician. He played the trombone. And he sat on the piano bench with me and explained the mysteries of music to me. So my father was my first mentor. And that continued, and I had some early success. In the early teenage years, I would win some contests, and it was enough. It sort of pushed it, and I kept with it. And I studied it when I went 2 years to Indiana University. I wanted to go to Chicago University and study the great books, but we were still in the Depression. This was 1941. And at Indiana, I studied music with a teacher who was a student of Busoni. So I had a lot of education in that. And then I went to the Army for 3 years. And, of course, it was impossible to study anything there. And when I got out, I had all the war points for college. I had 35 months of college. And I always wanted to go to Columbia. And I applied, and I was accepted. So, and all the time I was at Columbia, I studied. And then after my bachelor's degree, I decided to take a master's in musicology, because it was all in music and so forth. That turned out to be a very stubborn, foolish mistake. By that time, I'd grown very fond of cultural history. And of course, the super, super Jacques Barzin was there, and he was the one that I have long since wanted to study with. But after I graduated in 50 with a master's degree, I played the piano, I taught the piano, I coached singers, and I toured as an accompanist. And the important thing that I had learned how I had changed is that I realized that I did not have the technique to be a soloist. And also, my insides had changed. I was no longer the performing type. I didn't want to be out and wow an audience. I had become much more of an interior person. So it was this experience. I was relaxing in the bathtub on the night of a concert in Salt Lake City. And one of those flashes came across my mind, which is, I don't want to do this anymore. And I just didn't.
And it's, I think it's so interesting when you read someone's memoir, because it's happened to so many of us, that flash comes in a moment of relaxation and the whole direction of your life is altered. But how did you choose television?
Television, I was 30 years old, and this was early 1950s. Television was not in its infancy. I tried to get a job in New York, and it was full. So they said, go to the provinces, learn how to do it, and they'll bring you back. Now, interesting, because I had a friend. His name was Kirk Browning, and he became a very celebrated director. He was the first one to do NBC operas. He did the Toscanini broadcasts and all things like that. He worked for NBC. And I went to see him, and I said, Kirk, do I want to do this? And he said, oh, of course you do. He says, they're only doing radio with pictures. They don't know what they're doing, and besides, you'll take Spinoza. Referring, I think, to my
degree. What did that mean?
That means you'll take some learning. And the interesting fact was that I finally got a job in the only place that I wanted to go outside of New York, which was Philadelphia. And I looked around to say, who's going to teach me? How am I going to learn how to do more than radio with pictures? And I couldn't find anybody. No one on the staff. I thought, no. So I said, well, I have to make up my own course. Now, at that time, the director operated his own board. He cut the shots himself. He dissolved the shots. He was responsible for making all the shots. So I would, at night, after the studio was closed, I would go upstairs to the control room, and I would practice. And I got on to how to do this. I took a lot with piano, with my piano lessons. They took a lot of information with me. I learned how to be an accompanist. I learned how to learn. I found that all those directors, every time they stop and they go back to the beginning. And that, you don't do that when you learn piano. You find out where your trouble spot is, and then you work on it.
Right.
Then you put it all together.
I found that fascinating, the way that you took music rehearsing or music practice to television rehearsing. And that did work. It made the whole process much more efficient.
Oh, yes. And I knew who I wanted to model after. I wanted to know who was operating in television and films that I could learn from. Not teach me, but learn from. And I chose two. One was Dwight Hemion, who was very big in those days in doing musicals. And I remember thinking or seeing or hearing that he was the first person I ever knew who used two cranes. Well, that was unheard of. I mean, a crane in Philadelphia was unheard of. So this was, I watched him.
Meaning crane shots, cranes with cameras in them to do television.
That's right. They weren't done that. It was all three cameras, big, bulky cameras on the floor, and you had those to play with. And usually you had two cameras. So it was very, very at the beginning. And then the other one that I followed that I liked his movies, and that was William Wyler. I found that he knew how to frame a shot, what the size of a frame should be. Also, he knew how the sequence of telling a story. And I think the best example of that I can give was for film that everyone knows, which is Betty Davis in The Letter.
Right.
Which is a brilliant, brilliant technical film of just how you put the story together and how... And he didn't have all the tight shots that got very popular when some stations came in. So that was my education.
It's interesting to me, because I hadn't thought about it before I started reading your book, that television, in a way, was more like radio at that time than like film, because so much of it was live.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And remember, at that time, there was no Los Angeles. And all of the owned stations, because WCAU in Philadelphia was a CBS station, and it was one owned stations. There's New York, Philadelphia, St. Louis, Chicago, and Los Angeles, finally. And they bought, at that time, CBS bought its programming from one of the owned stations. So Philadelphia was doing 7 hours a week for the network. So that's why they had employment and how I could get a job and how I could learn.
And it seems that there was so much more freedom and so much more room for genuine artistry, both in terms of you, the TV producer, being an artist and collaborating with some of the greatest artists of your day. I mean, you went back eventually to New York City, and you worked with someone named Dan Gallagher, who had gone into television because he wanted his world to be filled with art. It's hard to even imagine that at this point.
Isn't it true? Well, that's what I quote, and I don't remember the quote exactly, but I can hear the context of it, is Sigourney Weaver's father, Pat Weaver, was an executive at NBC. And he said, this is the way you educate all people. You don't play to small groups. Everybody can experience the arts and the sciences. Everything can be experienced by them. Well, then we know what happened when Los Angeles came.
Yeah, it became about profit.
Yeah. You know, it was a commercial station. It was, so I remember at that time, you could have, we were permitted, or 2 minutes of commercial in a 30-minute show. And now, that would be 4 minutes in an hour's show.
Right.
I'm a big fan of Keith Olbermann. And I watched him once and counted the commercials. 17 minutes in an hour's show.
Yeah.
So that's the way it's changed. And then in the 50s, remember, that's when we had all the Studio Ones and all of the arts programs. And Patty Chayefsky was writing it. All the writers were writing dramas, music. It was all there.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it got to be 60s, and head of the FCC, it's a vast wasteland. And it became, and that's when, in the late 80s, I decided to leave. Because it leans more and more to what it is now, which is pop culture.
Right.
And it's explainable because television is expensive. So they feel they have to do, so it's all for audiences and young audiences and all of that. We didn't worry about any of that.
Well, you had an amazing program called Camera 3. Tell us about that.
Camera 3 was a half-hour program on CBS that started, I think, in 1953. It started in New York, so I was in Philadelphia, so I was not there. It's what developed as, it's a sign of the times, that it said, this is a producer's choice. And they gave it the label of, it's a walk through the marketplace of ideas. They could do anything they wanted, any subject they wanted, any person they wanted. They were all, how would you describe it? None of them were ignorant, these guests. They were people who had something to share with an audience. And when I was pulled back to New York, I must say reluctantly, because I loved Philadelphia, and I thought I could be. I was doing the Philadelphia Orchestra at that time, and I could be there. But my friends thought differently, so they pushed me, and I went to New York. And that I'd been to Philadelphia 9 years. And in New York, Dan Gallagher, who had been spying on me in my control room, finally said, I want you to come to New York. And he said, I want you to go and talk to some people in New York at CBS. And I would go, and I would talk to them, and they would say to me, well, there's no job. And I would go back, and he said, well, you know, they always say that you audition them. And I guess I did, because I wasn't eager to go.
Yeah.
But finally he said, oh, you know, Meryl, come on. We'll find a lot for you to do. And he did. And they were a series, and we tried everything, and it was all fun, and I was learning as I was going. And then they finally said, we'd like you to do Camera 3, which was came from that station, WCBS. And I said, let me think, because Camera 3 had now become what seemed to me to be what a director was using to get to do movies.
Right. And I find it fascinating. You didn't want to do movies. You were very interested in using the limitations and the medium of television, which really was different.
That's correct.
What was it about TV that you liked?
I loved it. I loved to learn. I learned to love it. Because it had so many possibilities, and it's had right up in the possibilities it has now.
People were watching it on such small screens.
Yes, and that's the reason, because it was small screens, and there were small sets, and only the people with more money could have them. So that's why it was all. But as you expanded your audience, they didn't know what, some of these people on the outskirts didn't know what you were talking about. But I had my regular audience, and when I went to, finally I said, well, they said, oh, perhaps you think you can't do it. Well, I came out with my nose flaring, you know, and to join the arena, because don't ever tell me you don't think I can do it. And I went in, and I insisted the rules still held. Producer's choice, and that's the way. It was like a postgraduate education for me.
And so on Camera 3, that was a program with performing arts,
anything.
Dance, music, mm-hmm. some visual arts, everything. And you could basically choose who you were going to have on the show.
And you know, and I was in New York, and it's all in New York.
Yeah.
So I could have everybody. I had Beverly Sills.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it turned out to be great.
Now, how did you get introduced to and really fall in love with dance?
That's my Martha story.
Yeah.
Well, I'll keep brief on that. So when I was at Columbia, a young man said he invited me to go with him to a concert. And he said, it's Martha. I didn't know who Martha was. I said, well, what? He said, Martha is a great concert modern dancer. She invented her own language. Oh, I was getting interesting. Because I didn't know anything about concert dance or modern dance. Because where I came from, all they did is waltz. So anyway, I said, well, I'm getting interested. And that's when we took the bus over to WAMHA. And I watched, and there was this solo, and I talk about it. This little woman was on the stage, and I was watching her, and suddenly it was as if she grabbed my gut and rolled it in the air, threw it up, slammed it down, and very tenderly picked it up and cradled it. And as I say, I was forever disciple of Martha Graham's. So that was my first introduction. So I began to say to everybody, well, you know, I don't care what you say about that style of dancing. Martha Graham is mother's milk to me. And that was the case until I met Valentine.
We're talking to Meryl Brockway, television producer and director. His new memoir is called Surprise Was My Teacher. So you met George Balanchine, and at first, the New York City Ballet didn't want to work with you. You started working on Dance in America, and then the New York City Ballet at first didn't want to work with you because television was too vulgar a medium.
Yes, that was Lincoln Kirsten's example. But I have to tell you that when I was still on camera three, I knew about Pierre Boulez when I was a student, but I finally went to a concert in New York, and I asked him if he would like to be on television. And he said yes. And Pierre became my first teacher. And he would do something. He later came to the Philharmonic, and every year we would have Philharmonic musicians, and he would do a concert, a television concert. So he was my teacher, and I learned more about music that I didn't know. Pierre had an interesting habit. He'd have a new piece. He would have them play it from the beginning to the end. He would find out where the trouble spots were, and then he'd work on those. And when they were worked out, then I went to... He invited me to go with him to a concert, New York City Chamber Music. And he had been commissioned to do a piece. He did it. He rehearsed it, and I'd never heard it played at the end all the way through. He didn't mind. He taught me respect. And the other one who was respect was Balanchine for his dancers, Pierre for his musicians. It's all built with respect for them.
It's also amazing how much they respected you. Your collaboration with George Balanchine, who is one of the greatest geniuses of the 20th century in art and dance, his collaboration with you is really striking. He went seamlessly and very inventively with you from this medium of dance in a theater to this medium of television and editing and going from camera to camera and shot to shot, and do you use the whole body or only the mm-hmm. upper body or the mm-hmm. face or only the feet? And he was right there every step of the way, and apparently just a terrific thinker and collaborator with you.
It's true. Collaboration was the single element that persuaded Balanchine. He said to me when it was finally arranged, after Lincoln had said it'll never appear on anything as vulgar as television, and then we noticed that when I was announced that I was going to be series producer of Dance in America, we noticed that Barbara Horgan, who was Balanchine's right hand, it slipped into the back of the audience. So I just took it as a cue. So I sent him a letter saying that I was the new boy on the block and that this new series that I was going to be the producer-director of would be unconscionable to call it Dance in America without his participation. So Barbara arranged a lunch, and I determined I wasn't going to be pushy. And at lunch, he wanted to tell me about his Hollywood experiences, because he liked film. He liked television. He watched it. Wonder Woman was his favorite program. So he had some initial instinct. And when I said, there are two things that really sold it. One, he asked me about me. What did I do? And I told him that I was a pianist. I studied piano and studied music. What is never quite talked about enough was what an incredible musician Balanchine was. He was a musician before he was a choreographer. And what happened is that I got so that I could listen to a piece by the music, and I knew where the cuts were. Because he was right with the music.
And, of course, you were originally a musician as well.
Yeah, and he liked that. Yeah. He said, everybody wants to talk to me about ballet. But, well, I did want to talk about ballet, but we talk about music, and he told me how he did certain things and how he made Midsummer Night's Dream and all that kind of thing. It took him 10 years because he didn't want any composed transitions. He wanted only Mendelssohn.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the other thing that attracted him was he'd had bad experience in the mid-70s. A German producer had hired the company to go to Germany and record, I think, 13 ballets. There were three different directors. Each director had a different theory about directing dance. So each one did his theory, and Balanchine says, that's not the way, you know, if you want to do that, why don't you choreograph your own piece? Don't do that to my piece.
Right.
But they didn't know, you don't separate a German from his theory. So Balanchine came home, and he was disgusted with it, with the whole thing. But yes, began to be invigorated and began to be interested. And we that's why we got along. Collaboration was the thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to take a piece and make it totally mine. I wanted to know what the intention of the choreographer was. So that if I didn't like the choreographer, I didn't hire him.
It is remarkably like being an accompanist.
Absolutely. Because I knew, I want his ideas. He knows more than I do. And he was very helpful. And after our first lunch, he said to me, first he said, well, I don't do any stories, only one story, Prodigal Son, have I done, and you want stories. And I began some elaborate explanation how music was a story and it has one thing leads to another and so forth. I didn't know what in the hell I was talking about. But he listened and he said, well, I never thought of it like that. So,
which is amazing because he's the master of the abstract musical ballet
absolutely.
That tells a sort of abstract story.
Absolutely. And then he said to me, as we were parted, he said, how much you know about ballet? And I said, nothing. He said, good, I teach you.
Yeah, I mean, what a wonderful thing, really, for both of you, because for you, you got to work with this great master, and you worked with a lot of people besides him, but you got to work with this great master, and some of this work is now preserved in this beautiful way. I mean, are people able to Netflix or rent or see the Dance in America programs?
No. And I tell you why. Is because it was too difficult to negotiate the contracts.
That's too
bad. There were so many people involved. I have a music library, a video library. I was there when videotape started. And so I began taping right from the beginning, anything that was on. So I had a pretty vast video library. And I have given it to the National Dance Institute because I could see the training. Catherine Oppenheimer was my dear friend, the first person I met in Santa Fe. And she... It's her training is the most beautiful thing I've seen, how you train people. And there are a lot of little secrets to it.
And, of course, she was trained by the New York City Ballet and
yes,
her Ballet.
So we talk the same language.
Yeah.
Suzanne Farrell and I talk the same language. Peter Bowl in Seattle talk the same language.
All of whom have been brought to the Lenzic, thanks to.
Yeah, because that's what I would like to see. They have great variety. And I want the audience, I find the audience in Santa Fe quite fascinating. They, unless they came from San Francisco or Seattle or Salt Lake City or maybe Houston, they've never seen ballet. So I don't like imposters, people who say they are a ballet company when they're not. And so I wanted the Santa Fe audience to see ballets. And the first one I brought was the New York City Ballet with Balanchine and Robbins. And then Suzanne came, and she did two programs of Balanchine. So they had a lot of Balanchine repertoire. Then I started bringing Peter Bowl. And he does a lot of different things. But Peter and I had become very good friends. He was not there during Balanchine, but he is the most secure with the Balanchine way of working. He works exactly, they all work exactly the same way as Balanchine, which is simple, direct, tell them, and watch. It's one of those watch and listen systems.
How did you end up in Santa Fe? You worked in television and produced just countless programs of Merce Cunningham, Martha Graham, Twyla Tharp, so many others, in some international dance companies as well. And then you landed here, of all places.
When I decided I had one of those flashes again, when I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I said, I'm going to leave New York, because it had gotten very loud, and I wanted to leave television because it was going in a direction that I didn't like. But I said, you know, where will you go? And I said, I've had a little town, and I've had a big city. So I don't think I want to do this. I don't think I want to go, although I like Seattle very much, until I found out that it rains most of the time. And I like Vancouver, same thing. But I knew, because I traveled a lot, and I'd been on all the continents, and I knew that I was not an expatriate, that I was really an American. And I wanted to be here, but where? And it's like I figured out my regions. I barely flew over the Midwest. And I've been in New York and New England. I don't belong in the South. I didn't want to go to Los Angeles. They make film, and I didn't want to be involved with films. And I've stopped over on my way west to see a friend who lived here. She'd moved from New York to Santa Fe, and she showed me a tour that was very informative. And I thought, well, now this is something to see, to think about, because I like the Southwest. I love the weather. I love the light. I loved all the physical things. So I made up a schedule. I knew I'd come to the opera, so I knew summer. I didn't know the other seasons. So I made a schedule that I would come in January, May, and October. And I would rent a house in different parts of the city and come and live and find and learn about Santa Fe, because Santa Fe is very easy to fall in love with when you first come here. But I wanted to get underneath it and see what it was like to live here. And I did that for 3 years. And I fell out of love with Santa Fe, but I learned to love it.
Yeah, and you compare that to going from passionate affair to marriage.
Yeah.
You've sort of fall out of the infatuation, but you fall in love with it in a deeper way.
Yeah, I think I quote Jean Moreau, who said, "You know, you don't fall in love. You don't get married when you're in love. You fall out of love, and then you get to love, and then you get married."
Merrill Brockway is author of the new memoir, Surprise Was My Teacher, Memories and Confessions of a Television Producer-Director Who Came of Age During Television's Adolescence. And once again, he will be at Collected Works Bookstore doing a reading and book signing this Friday, the 23rd of April, at 6 in the evening. I'm sorry we're out of time. There's so many more interesting stories, but people will just have to pick up a copy of the book.
Oh, I hope so.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.